You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Every ground shift in politics needs a narrative, and every narrative needs characters. And for a rising Republican politician dead set on reversing four decades of expanding government benefits, the single most important character was a villain, a person who newspapers came to call the welfare queen.
She has used 127 names so far, posed as a mother of 14 children at one time, seven at another, signed up twice with the same caseworker in 4 days, and once while on welfare, posed as an open-heart surgeon, complete with office.
I had long understood Welfare Queen to be something that Ronald Reagan invented from whole cloth, because making up convenient stories was something that Reagan was very prone to doing. But it turns out she was an actual person. Our next guest has devoted an entire book to digging up the story of the person behind the myth of the welfare queen. Josh Levine is the editorial director of Slate. His new book is The Queen. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't you start by describing how you got started going down this rabbit hole?
It was 2012. Just before election day of the Romney-Obama election. And I was working with a colleague of mine at Slate at the time named Tom Skoka. And Tom was writing a piece about Romney in which his premise was, let's dissect the tribal appeal of Mitt Romney to the tribe of white people. This was his premise. And during the editing process, for whatever reason, a reason that was fortuitous for me, Tom sent me a link to a Jet magazine piece from the 70s on Linda Taylor, which laid out that Taylor was reputed to be the biggest welfare cheat of all time, that she drove a Cadillac, all of the kind of basic elements of the story. And as you noted in your intro, similarly for me, I didn't know that the term welfare queen had been attached to the specific person. And so I was interested in who this person was, but I was also interested in why I didn't know that, why she had been erased from this story that had been created in her image.
All right, well, let's talk about who Linda Taylor was. First of all, she was not born Linda Taylor.
She was born Martha Louise White in a kind of fantastically named town that I also did not know existed, Gold Dust, Tennessee. It's like, sounds like, the name of a town that you would make up. And she used all sorts of different names in her life, but that was the one that she was born with in the 20s in the Deep South in this family, this white family that kind of moved around the South in search of work. They moved to various cotton plantations. And Martha, as she was known at that time, was mixed race. And as I discovered in my reporting, she was essentially exiled from her own family, mistreated because of her race. And so that was a discovery that I made that really affected how I thought about her.
So she's got this intense sense of dislocation. Growing up in a white family, she's probably better equipped to navigate multiple strata of society than other people growing up black around her time. And some of the initial deceptions you document her going through is lying about her race on government documents to get around anti-miscegenation laws.
Yeah, so before the incident that you mentioned, she's listed as white on the census in 1930 and 1940 when she was around 4 and 14 years old. And this was in Arkansas. And at that time, there's a statute in that state that essentially made it illegal to have cohabitation between white folks and black folks. And so
she couldn't live with her parents.
Exactly. And it was even more stark than that in some ways, where it's written explicitly into the law that if a white woman has, a quote-unquote mulatto child, then that's evidence that she's committed a felony. So Taylor herself, or Martha at that time, if she had been deemed, you know, officially mixed race black, then she would have been evidence against her mother. She would have been, you know, like the title of the Trevor Noah book, Born a Crime. Then when she moves out west to Oakland in the 1940s, she meets a white man who's in the Navy, and they get married. And on the marriage license that I found, she's self-described as Hawaiian, which at that time, because of the miscegenation laws in the state, it was okay for a white person to marry a Hawaiian. It was not legal for white person, black person to get married.
So she's someone who, because of her race and her context, kind of has to go through these kind of pretty profound lies just as a matter of basic survival.
Sure.
What's her first grift?
From what I was able to find, that marriage that I mentioned, her husband says in divorce documents that she was a compulsive liar, that she lied about who she was, about her past. He seems to perhaps not have known about her racial background. And he alleges that she abused their children, that she, you know, would take them away without warning, and they'd come back and look dirty and depressed. And there's this kind of, you know, linkage, interconnection between her her crimes, her deception, and this penchant for abuse.
Walk me kind of through the full scope of her criminal enterprises. In that soundbite from Ronald Reagan, he makes reference to her impersonating a heart surgeon.
What I found in my research is that a lot of the times, the more outrageous stuff that was written and reported about her was more true than kind of the more mundane stuff. So the amount of her welfare fraud, which was repeated by Reagan and had its origins in the Chicago Tribune and other outlets, that was typically very exaggerated. But when they said she had been accused of kidnapping, that was true. When they said that she had been suspected of murder, that was true. When they said she had posed as a heart surgeon, that was definitely true.
She also impersonated a voodoo priest.
Yes. So as a con artist and a grifter, Taylor had this gift, this ability to be whoever the person that was in front of her wanted her to be or needed her to be. And she would prey on people who believed that she had the ability to commune with spirits. So whether she claimed she was a voodoo priest, which she did at sometimes, or a psychic, it was all about her ability to tell people, to communicate with spirits, to tell people when they were going to die, to tell people when their loved ones were going to die. These very intimate kinds of details and things where if she could convince you that she was able to access this information, and she was very convincing, then you would be willing to pay money to hear this. And I talked to many people who attested to how convincing she would be and how, you know, foolish they feel in retrospect. But in the moment, she had this kind of power, this emotional intelligence to be able to, like, worm her way inside of people.
And then there are the kidnapping allegations.
I feel comfortable saying that she was a kidnapper, not just an alleged kidnapper. She was arrested for it in Chicago in 1967 for taking a girl that wasn't her own. She wasn't ultimately charged, and I wasn't able to figure out why. That's something that recurs, that she's arrested for things and not charged or not punished for it. And then there are other kidnappings that I became aware of just through interviews that she was never charged with. But one of the big unsolved mysteries in the book centers around what to this day remains unsolved and is one of the most notorious crimes in the history of Chicago, which was the kidnapping of a day-old baby from his mother's arms in a Chicago hospital by a woman dressed as a nurse. Taylor was known to dress as a nurse and to claim that she was a nurse. Various people said that they believed that she had done it. I know for a fact that the FBI investigated her for it, but the FBI hasn't made its case file available because they say it's an ongoing investigation still 55 years later, but the baby was never found and that nobody was ever charged with that crime.
So you're painting this portrait of this incredibly complicated character, some deep traumas, partially because of her upbringing, extremely fluent in lying and comfortable with lying and able to get very far on that. How does she come to be known only by her relatively small-scale welfare fraud?
Even though her other crimes were more horrifying, the welfare fraud was seen as, at once, more kind of fascinating and interesting to the paper's journalists and readership, and also more galling, because if Taylor kidnaps someone or kills someone, how does that affect, a American taxpayer? But if she steals welfare money, she's stealing it from the pockets of these hardworking Americans. At least that's how it was portrayed, and that's how Reagan portrayed it when he started talking about her on the campaign trail. This was a crime that she committed against America and against Americans, and that's why she was a villain, not because she'd done bad things on a person-to-person level, that she'd harmed people. It was because of this crime she'd perpetrated that was, like, offensive to everyone.
So all the things she could have been charged with, the welfare fraud was the one that stuck.
Yeah.
Describe what the end result of that trial was.
So her lawyer's strategy to make this into a big picture case about, how this was a demonization of the poor. That didn't work. It was a noble effort, but in the end, she gets convicted. She gets sentenced to 3 to 7 years in state prison, and she goes to prison in 1978. And at that point, the window, really shuts, and her brief period of being a public figure ends. Like, as soon as she goes behind bars, it's not just that nothing is written about her in the future, it's that she's erased from history. People kind of, there's a collective amnesia around the fact that she was a real person and that she ever existed.
So I'm curious, I think you made a pretty good argument for why welfare fraud, one of the most minor of her crimes, was the one that kind of stuck in the press and in the political sphere. But she's arrested on kidnapping. She's more than credibly accused of murder, or at least homicide. Why didn't those get prosecuted?
So the kidnapping charge in 1967, this will be an unsatisfying answer, but I don't know, because the records haven't been preserved and all of the police officials who were involved in that case are dead. So I don't have an answer to that one. On the homicide, I do have an answer. And just to give folks some background on this case, it's 1975. It's after Taylor has become known as the welfare queen. She's out on bond, awaiting trial after she's been indicted. And she moves in with a friend of hers, someone she met at church, named Patricia Parks. Patricia Parks is sick, and Taylor moves in and promises to take care of her to make her better. But Patricia Parks just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. And she dies eventually, and she's found to have died of a barbiturate overdose. And Patricia Parks's family believes that Taylor killed her, and One thing that adds to their suspicion, and rightly so, is that just before Parks' death, she names Taylor the executor of her estate. And the state's attorney's office in Cook County in Chicago sees her as a suspect. This isn't just something that the family believes. The prosecutor who prosecutes her for welfare fraud writes to the FBI to try to get them to help, tries to get the hospital to provide blood samples from, you know, to compare from before and after the woman's death. And he believes he's not able to get to acquire the evidence that he needs to bring charges. And he told me, you know, I knew I could win the welfare fraud case. And so I decided to focus on that. So it's partly understandable. And yet the Chicago Tribune writes about the suspected homicide, but they don't crusade about it. Nobody writes, this is an outrage that this woman isn't getting prosecuted. It's almost just like it's used as kind of color or shading to say, oh, you know, that welfare queen we've been writing about, she's also accused of homicide.
Murderers can get welfare benefits.
But they're writing editorials about how welfare fraud is horrible. Politicians are talking about how she exemplifies all these problems with the welfare system. But at this time, you know, in 1974, the year she's arrested for welfare fraud, there are 970 murders in Chicago that year, which is the most ever still to this day in the city of Chicago. But Patricia Parks' ex-husband told me, you know, because my wife was black, nobody cared. Like, it wasn't a big issue. A Black Tribune reporter told me, we were told not to cover murders on the south and west sides of the city. And so I think there's a very strong argument to be made that whether it was the Tribune or politicians, the potential murder of a black woman in Chicago was a non-event and a non-story. And welfare fraud, particularly the quote-unquote biggest welfare fraud in the history of America, that was huge.
She lives more than two decades after she's sent away to prison. What does the rest of her life look like?
So this is all stuff I had to reconstruct myself because nothing was written about her and nobody knew. Nobody could tell me. But I was able to find out that after she gets out, she had been married before she went to prison to a man named Sherman Ray. She moves with her husband to a small town outside Chicago. And a man that Taylor knew and was acquainted with shoots and kills her husband, Sherman Ray. Taylor collects life insurance policies after her husband's death and then moves to Florida with a man who killed her husband, which is kind of an unusual move, I would argue. And then when she's in Florida, she commits more crimes and she eventually gets arrested and charged there with embezzlement, with stealing an old woman's pension checks, a woman who also died under suspicious circumstances. And so she gets, this time in the federal system, she's put in a federal prison. Her mental health is evaluated. She's eventually deemed incompetent to stand trial and put in a state facility. And at that point, it's up to her kids to decide what they want to do with her.
I guess playing to type is kind of the foundation of every con. And she carried that right through the type expectations that the Chicago Tribune and the 1976 Reagan campaign created for her.
She did have an ability to be different people. And very quickly when she became known as this welfare cheat, some of the first articles noted her ability to change identities and change her race, that she could portray herself as being different races. And that was seen as one of the prime examples of her deviousness. That's how it was described at the time. That's why it was so interesting to me to learn about her early life and how her ability to pass was a survival mechanism. And that really complicates this idea that she was using race in this devious way. Like,
well, also interesting that passing and code switching are seen as threatening and sinister.
Yeah, for sure. And it was, again, this thing that recurs is there's a kind of incoherence in a lot of the commentary around her. Like, she's at once extraordinary and typical. She is at once coded as Black. And when Reagan talks about her, welfare has been so racialized at that point that it's like there's no mistaking who he's, the imagined person that he's talking about. And yet at the same time, she's like racially ambiguous. The folks who were talking about her and pontificating about her and speechifying about her, there was a consistent embrace of inconsistency or incoherence. There didn't need to be some kind of like totally straightforward through line and explanation. It's just, you know, and looking back at all of this coverage, like, how could people be writing this stuff and saying this stuff all at once? And, you know, they just did, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, the way she plays into that expectation, wearing the fur coat to trial, it makes it sound like she and Ronald Reagan are Confederates in a bigger con. A con about, you know, the nature of the welfare state in America.
Yeah, I mean, for her, I'm not sure that that was her goal and her intention, but she probably helped him out, I think, in some ways. I think at that moment in history, because for Reagan, it was really important for him to be able to speak to his accomplishments in California as a welfare reformer, and for him also to be able to talk about race without being explicit about race, and welfare was a great way for him to do that. It was kind of overdetermined that he was going to tell a story like this. And so I think, despite the fact that I wrote a whole book on her, and I think she's just this extraordinarily fascinating character, I feel like if Reagan hadn't come across her, he would have found somebody else to fill that slot. For him, she was unimportant as a human. She was important as a signifier and as, you know, as a story he could tell to get the response he felt he needed.
And he never referred to her by name, just woman in Chicago.
On the campaign trail, he always referred to her as woman in Chicago. He did refer to her by name in a couple of non-campaign appearances. So when he loses the nomination in 76, he goes back to being, he's like a radio guy. That's how he got to start. He goes back to doing syndicated radio commentaries. I believe he mentions her name in that. And then there's this press conference I found where a member of the media says, you've been, you know, confronts him and says, you've been, you know, exaggerating these claims. You've been telling these untruths. And in that press conference, Reagan like pulls out a piece of paper. He's very prepared for this. And he says, her name's Linda Taylor. For him, it was the only time in which it was important that she was a specific person, was a specific name, was when he needed to refute an allegation that he was a fabulist. Hmm.
And from Chicago was all the signaling America needed to encode the welfare queen as Black woman.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's that plus just welfare recipient, because at that point, after the civil rights movement and the welfare rights movement, when Black women in particular start to receive benefits that they had historically been denied, that they had been entitled to and denied, at that point, welfare just becomes like super racialized and coded as Black. So when somebody talks about a welfare cheat, especially, as you noted, a woman in Chicago in the mid-1970s, there's no mistaking what demographic group is being referred to there.
Well, Josh Levine, Thank you for the 6 years that went into making this happen. And thanks for coming in to talk about it.
You're very welcome.
Josh Levine is editorial director at Slate. His new book is The Queen. It is the story of the actual person behind the myth that Ronald Reagan created around a so-called welfare queen.
And that takes us to 8 o'clock in the morning here at KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KPFB 89.3 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, K248BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, and online around the world, www.kpfa.org. The program is up front. My name is Brian Edwards Teeger. Kat Brooks is on vacation for the remainder of this week, but she'll be back with us on Monday. Coming up in the second hour of this program, we're going to start talking to documentarian Tim Travers Hawkins about his new documentary on Chelsea Manning, specifically the post-release period of her life and her return to jail under grand jury contempt charges. In the second half of the hour, we're going to take a dive into the history of relationships between Saudi Arabia and Iran. They're both regional rivals. The United States lands squarely on the side of Saudi Arabia. How did things get that way? We'll speak to Dr. Christian Coates Ulrichsen. All that and more coming up next after the news.